Part 6, Section A. In light of our conclusion that there is no jurisdictional bar to the district courts entertaining petitioner's claims, the question remains whether there are prudential barriers to habeas corpus review under these circumstances. The government argues petitioners must seek review of their CSRT determinations in the Court of Appeals before they can proceed with their habeas corpus actions in the district court. As noted earlier, in other contexts and for prudential reasons, this court has required exhaustion of alternative remedies before a prisoner can seek federal habeas relief. Most of these cases were brought by prisoners in state custody and thus involved federalism concerns that are not relevant here. But we have extended this rule to require defendants in courts martial to exhaust their military appeals before proceeding with a federal habeas corpus action. The real risks and real threats of terrorist attacks are constant and not likely soon to abate. The ways to disrupt our life and laws are so many and unforeseen that the court should not attempt even some general catalog of crises that might occur. Certain principles are apparent, however. Practical considerations and exigent circumstances inform the definition and reach of our law's writs, including habeas corpus. The cases and our tradition reflect this precept. In cases involving foreign citizens detained abroad by the executive, it likely would be both an impractical and unprecedented extension of judicial power to assume that habeas corpus would be available at the moment the prisoner is taken into custody. If and when habeas corpus jurisdiction applies, as it does in these cases, then proper deference can be accorded to reasonable procedures for screening and initial detention under lawful and proper conditions of confinement and treatment for a reasonable period of time. Domestic exigencies, furthermore, might also impose such onerous burdens on the government that here, too, the judicial branch would be required to devise sensible rules for staying habeas corpus proceedings until the government can comply with its requirements in a responsible way. If in foreign invasion or civil war the courts are actually closed and it is impossible to administer criminal justice according to law, then on the theater of active military operations where war really prevails, there is a necessity to furnish a substitute for the civil authority thus overthrown to preserve the safety of the army and society. And as no power is left but the military, it is allowed to govern by martial rule until the laws can have their free course. Here, as is true with detainees apprehended abroad, a relevant consideration in determining the court's role is whether there are suitable alternative processes in place to protect against the arbitrary exercise of governmental power. The cases before us, however, do not involve detainees who have been held for a short period of time while awaiting their CSRT determinations. Were that the case, or were it probable that the Court of Appeals could complete a prompt review of their applications, the case for requiring temporary abstention or exhaustion of alternative remedies would be much stronger. These qualifications no longer pertain here. In some of these cases, 6 years have elapsed without the judicial oversight that habeas corpus or an adequate substitute demands. And there has been no showing that the executive faces such onerous burdens that it cannot respond to habeas corpus actions. To require these detainees to complete DTA review before proceeding with their habeas corpus actions would be to require additional months, if not years, of delay. The first DTA review applications were filed over a year ago, but no decisions on the merits have been issued. While some delay in fashioning new procedures is unavoidable, the costs of delay can no longer be borne by those who are held in custody. The detainees in these cases are entitled to a prompt habeas corpus hearing. Our decision today holds only that the petitioners before us are entitled to seek the writ, that the DTA review procedures are an inadequate substitute for habeas corpus, and that the petitioners in these cases need not exhaust the review procedures in the Court of Appeals before proceeding with their habeas actions in the district court. The only law we identify as unconstitutional is MCA Section 7. Accordingly, both the DTA and the CSRT process remain intact. Our holding with regard to exhaustion should not be read to imply that a habeas court should intervene the moment an enemy combatant steps foot in a territory where their writ runs. The executive is entitled to a reasonable period of time to determine a detainee's status before a court entertains that detainee's habeas corpus petition. The CSRT process is the mechanism Congress and the President set up to deal with these issues. Except in cases of undue delay, federal courts should refrain from entertaining an enemy combatant's habeas corpus petition at least until after the department, acting via the CSRT, has had a chance to review his status. Section B. Although we hold that the DTA is not an adequate and effective substitute for habeas corpus, it does not follow that a habeas corpus court may disregard the dangers the detention in these cases were intended to prevent. Felker, Swain, and Heyman stand for the proposition that the suspension clause does not resist innovation in the field of habeas corpus. Certain accommodations can be made to reduce the burden habeas corpus proceedings will place on the military without impermissibly diluting the protections of the writ. In the DTA, Congress sought to consolidate review of petitioners' claims in the courts of appeals. Channeling future cases to one district court would no doubt reduce administrative burdens on the government. This is a legitimate objective that might be advanced even without an amendment to Section 2241. If in a future case a detainee files a habeas petition in another judicial district in which a proper respondent can be served, the government can move for a change of venue to the court that will hear these petitioners' cases, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Another of Congress's reasons for vesting exclusive jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals, perhaps, was to avoid the widespread dissemination of classified information. The government has raised similar concerns here and elsewhere. We make no attempt to anticipate all of the evidentiary and access to counsel issues that will arise during the course of the detainee's habeas corpus proceedings. We recognize, however, that the government has a legitimate interest in protecting sources and methods of intelligence gathering, and we expect that the district court will use its discretion to accommodate this interest to the greatest extent possible. These and the other remaining questions are within the expertise and competence of the district court to address in the first instance. In considering both the procedural and substantive standards used to impose detention to prevent acts of terrorism, proper deference must be accorded to the political branches. Unlike the President and some designated members of Congress, neither the members of this court nor most federal judges begin the day with briefings that may describe new and serious threats to our nation and its people. The law must accord the executive substantial authority to apprehend and detain those who pose a real danger to our security. Officials charged with daily operational responsibility for our security may consider a judicial discourse on the history of the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679 and like matters to be far removed from the nation's present urgent concerns. Established legal doctrine, however, must be consulted for its teaching. Remote in time it may be, irrelevant to the present it is not. Security depends upon a sophisticated intelligence apparatus and the ability of our armed forces to act and to interdict. There are further considerations, however. Security subsists, too, in fidelity to freedom's first principles. Chief among these are freedom from arbitrary and unlawful restraint, and the personal liberty that is secured by adherence to the separation of powers. It is from these principles that the judicial authority to consider petitions for habeas corpus relief derives. Our opinion does not undermine the executive's powers as commander-in-chief. On the contrary, the exercise of those powers is vindicated, not eroded, when confirmed by the judicial branch. Within the Constitution's separation of powers structure, few exercises of judicial power are as legitimate or as necessary as the responsibility to hear challenges to the authority of the executive to imprison a person. Some of these petitioners have been in custody for 6 years with no definitive judicial determination as to the legality of their detention. Their access to the writ is a necessity to determine the lawfulness of their status, even if, in the end, they do not obtain the relief they seek. Because our nation's past military conflicts have been of limited duration, it has been possible to leave the outer boundaries of war powers undefined. If, as some fear, terrorism continues to pose dangerous threats to us for years to come, the court might not have this luxury. This result is not inevitable, however. The political branches, consistent with their independent obligations to interpret and uphold the Constitution, can engage in a genuine debate about how best to preserve constitutional values while protecting the nation from terrorism. It bears repeating that our opinion does not address the content of the law that governs petitioners' detention. That is a matter yet to be determined. We hold that petitioners may invoke the fundamental procedural protections of habeas corpus. The laws and Constitution are designed to survive and remain in force in extraordinary times. Liberty and security can be reconciled, and in our system they are reconciled within the framework of the law. The framers decided that habeas corpus, a right of first importance, must be a part of that framework, a part of that law. The determination by the Court of Appeals that the suspension clause and its protections are inapplicable to petitioners was in error. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed. The cases are remanded to the Court of Appeals with instructions that it remand the cases to the District Court for proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered.